Good afternoon. Members, please have a seat. We'll get started. I call this meeting of Human Services Finance Committee to order. Members, we have a quorum present. We will begin with the approval for the minutes from March 2022. Vice Chair Barnett, do you want to move the approval for minutes for March 2022?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So moved.
Vice Chair Banner moves the approval for the minutes of March 2022. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The minutes for March 2022 is now, March 22nd is now adopted. With that, members, we have two bills on the agenda today. And we will begin with House File 2847. That's the Governor's and Lieutenant Governor's recommendation. This bill will be laid over, and we will begin with the testimony of the Department. Director Bailey, welcome. Just wanted to let the committee know that we do have two amendments. And those amendments are only for discussion. We're not going to be taking them today. So I move that House File 2847 to be laid off for possible inclusion. Director Bailey, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Elise Bailey, the Budget Director for the Department of Human Services. And I do have a PowerPoint, but it's not. Thank you.
We'll take a brief moment to get the technical fix. There you go. The magic touch. We're having a little bit of technical difficulties.
Oh, it worked. All right. Par for the course, the kind of day I'm having. But it's up there. Okay, well, thank you, members. Again, I'm Elise Bailey, Budget Director for the Department of Human Services, and I know you have a lot of work to do today and testifiers, and so I'm just going to briefly breeze through the revised budget. We came to your committee, I think about a month ago, it seems like a decade ago, to reveal the initial budget, and so today I'm just going to condense my remarks to what's contained in the revised that is new. But I am starting out with our founding principles behind this budget. We've done a lot of work at the department and at the governor's office around what are the goals that we want to get out of this budget, and it's really, really centered around the people that we serve and really making it just simply work better for them. And so this slide kind of depicts all the key people involved in the complex human services system and the critical percent of the population that our programs serve. We also presented this earlier in session about the pillars that we had behind our budget package. And so I just wanted to keep this in the PowerPoint to remain keep it front of mind for you all on what our goals are to get out of the budget this year. Before I go further in, I do want to give a shout out to the team at DHS. A lot of the proposals contained in this bill have taken years actually to develop along with you all throughout the years, but countless hours, and they've put their hearts and souls into a lot of these ideas, and so just wanted to give a shout out to the team. So you'll see in this slide our total DHS budget package. So this spans all of the jurisdictions that DHS is a part of, and the revised budget comes to $4.9 billion over the 4 years. This is about $300 million over our initial budget, and we have 114 proposals total in our budget book. In this jurisdiction, it's our total is just over $1.9 billion over the 4 years in 34 separate proposals. So briefly, the new and revised proposals that we have before you. In our initial budget, we had a proposal called Database Rates for Residential and Own Home Services. This proposal implements a database rate methodology for ICFDDs, or intermediate care facilities for people with developmental disabilities. It also initially updated the timing that inflationary adjustments occur in the disability waiver rate system. What's new in this proposal is that we're using newer data when we do those inflationary adjustments, and so that's about $160 million more into the rates for DWRS. With that, we're incorporating thresholds that the provider has to meet to ensure that those funds actually get down to the actual direct care worker. The next slide goes over our older adult long-term care workforce package. This package provides a rate increase for the elderly waiver, alternative care, and essential community supports program. It also increases the monthly budgets for people on the consumer-directed community supports programs on EW and AC. What's new in this proposal is that we're also adding a requirement that providers provide at least 80% of the rate increase to the direct care workers that would be providing the service to people. So this next slide goes over a really big package that we are providing in this updated budget. This is addressing the opioid epidemic. And just to start off, just to ground us in what this proposal is really trying to achieve, opioid-involved overdose deaths in Minnesota increased by 44% in just 1 year, from 20 to 2021. And the number of deaths has more than doubled since 2019. That means that in 2021, almost 1,000 people, 978 people, lost their lives. And that means that countless friends, families, children, for decades and generations have been forever marked by what has happened with this opioid epidemic. When you look at the whole country, one person dies every 5 minutes. This is an emergency. When you look deeper into the data, those deaths are very different across different populations in Minnesota. While white mortality deaths are 10.7 per 100 people, Black Minnesotans are three times more likely to die than white from opioid overdose, and Native Minnesotans are 10 times more likely. Between 2020 and 2021, that disparity even increased even more. American Indian deaths rose by 47% in 1 year, and African American deaths increased by 37%. So we see this as an incredible point in time that we must do something. What you see in our initial proposal is we modified the membership on the Opioid Epidemic Response Advisory Council, or ORAC, to ensure that every tribal nation has a member on that committee. We added two members from the urban American Indian community and members from African American communities. We also ensured that at least 50% of the grants that that committee divvies out are going to disproportionately impact the communities, to reflect that data that we're seeing, that the money is going to where it's needed most. And we're also proposing ongoing funding for traditional healing grants and overdose prevention in the base. That was in our initial proposal, and in the new proposal we have several new components. First is we're removing the current sunset on fees paid by opioid manufacturers and distributors under current law. The fees that fund those ORAC grants, they get reduced in 2031 under current law. Given the data, we think the sunset should be removed. We need to have an ongoing investment to make sure that we can tackle this problem. So our proposal just repeals that sunset. We also have funding for competency-based training for the SUD provider community. We've done a lot of work in the last few years on transitioning providers to the American Society of Addiction Medicine, or ASAM, standards to increase the quality of care that people receive when they're accessing substance use disorder care. This proposal provides funding for those providers to be trained. We're also focusing in on family treatment programs to ensure that people have access, you know, people who have kids have access to programs that fit them in their lives. So we're establishing a work group to co-create administrative or legislative solutions to improve the access and the quality of those programs. We're also providing a $10 million appropriation for grants to family SUD treatment programs to improve their existing facilities, so capital money, or to expand access to new programs. In our proposal, we also have a requirement that every treatment center, every school, every publicly funded housing program, jail, and prison have naloxone on site. Also in our proposal provides training to use that naloxone. Another component of this proposal is implementation of a bad batch overdose surge text alert system. So currently we don't have a central place to collect and for communities to know when there's bad batches or large increases in overdose in their community. So this would provide a real-time central alert system that will increase the timeliness, the comprehensiveness, and the access to that overdose data in real time so that each community can know what's occurring and so that they can act appropriately. Another component of this proposal is a public awareness campaign directed towards youth to target the stigma of opioid use disorders, to really try to prevent and educate youth on the dangers associated with opioids. One of the largest components of this proposal is establishing and funding safe recovery sites. We're providing $12.5 million per year in startup and ongoing capacity funding for organizations who want to operate up to 15 safe recovery sites. These sites would offer services, supplies, such as sterile needle exchange, safe injection spaces, naloxone or Narcan, health monitoring, fentanyl testing, education and referrals for people who want to seek SUD treatment, or mental health services, housing, nutrition, healthcare, a one-stop shop for people suffering with substance use disorder. We have funding for culturally focused syringe service and needle exchange programs. So this is one key area where we're wanting to really dedicate funding to communities directly, so that they have access to syringes, testing supplies, and naloxone. And lastly, this proposal provides a technical assistance center for culturally specific organizations to help them navigate the really complex health and human services system we've built over time and to support the expansion of their programs. Another new proposal we have is called the acute care transition proposal. And this proposal is really trying to tackle the problem of people stuck in hospitals, no longer really meeting that acute level of care, but there's not an appropriate community-based provider who they can access care from. So we have three components within this proposal. One is providing a time-limited temporary payment for high-acuity admissions. So this temporary payment would go to the new provider who is willing to take that new admission from the hospital. And it would be providing payments for costs that they may incur outside of the normal Medicaid payment rate in order to serve the person with high needs. So this part of the proposal would be about $21 million, a one-time $21 million appropriation that would be available through June 30th, 2026. We're also looking to establish an ongoing proposal to establish an organizational endorsement system. So one big kind of issue that we've been grappling with is there's just not enough providers who are able to or who are willing to take people who have really high complex needs. So this is a strategy that we'd like to try where we would develop a special endorsement status for providers who demonstrate the competency and desire to serve folks. And when you do have that endorsement, they'll have access to enhanced resources, such as a comprehensive clinical panel that we would set up that would help them brainstorm solutions to each individual case they might maybe grappling with. They would have access to grant dollars at the department and person-centered planning and positive support training for them and their staff so that they can adequately support people with high acuity needs. And then lastly, in this proposal, we are expanding the elderly waiver program by offering an enhanced budget for people who have complex needs. that require intensive support to live in the community, but the current elderly waiver doesn't, the budgets don't currently support it. So this would serve people who leave, the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center, or AMRTC, the Minnesota Security Hospital, Community Behavioral Health Hospital, or for people who are hospitalized in the community and on a waiting list for AMRTC. And then lastly, a few other new proposals. We have a proposal on addressing the HIV epidemic in Minnesota. Due to some decreases in federal funding, we currently have a gap to continue the current level of services provided to folks with HIV, and so this proposal provides a one-time $12.1 million appropriation in 2024 to cover that current gap. We also have a gap in our operating expenses for direct care and treatment that was caused by workforce pressures. So this proposal provides $4.8 million in 23 to address that. And then lastly, we added a new proposal on MA-enteral feeding product rates. So this would establish a new rate methodology for that service in the medical assistance program. That investment is $3 million in 24-25 and $5 million in 26-27. And with that, I will, you want to take questions or?
Let's hear from the public testifiers, okay. And then we'll take questions. So the first one is Susan Florin, and then followed by Sue Hanka. Please come close to the testifiers, and then Josh Brady, please come close to the testify table. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed. And to the members of the public, you have 2 minutes. Sebastian will show you the sign. Please follow the 2 minutes. I don't want to cut anyone out. I know some people are passionate about some of these issues. If you have good signs, please don't use the signs in this room. We can always voice your concern in a different way. So please keep the decorum in the committee. Please go ahead and introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Knorr and members of the House Human Services Finance Committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Susan Florent, and I'm an attorney at the Minnesota Disability Law Center, a statewide division of Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid. The Minnesota Disability Law Center supports the wage increases and inflationary adjustments in this bill for workers who support Minnesotans with disabilities. As you know, many people who qualify for PCA and other services cannot get the help they need due to a shortage of workers, and we thank the chair and the governor for their efforts to attract and retain these critical workers to help Minnesotans with disabilities live independently. In addition, our organization supports rate increases for non-emergency medical transportation. These services are crucial to ensure that people with disabilities, particularly those who require accessible vehicles, have access to necessary medical care. The increases in this bill are a good start, but we urge the committee to consider the higher increases in House File 435. The Minnesota Disability Law Center also strongly supports the provisions in House File 2847 to increase wages for people with disabilities and phase out the subminimum wage. Our organization has spent several years developing our position on this issue, and our support for phasing out the subminimum wage is the result of years of research, consultation with organizations in other states, monitoring of subminimum wage employment sites, and engagement with clients and communities. In 2018, the state of Minnesota spent 10 times more on subminimum wage employment than the state spent on supporting community employment for people with disabilities. Minnesota falls behind other states in the percentage of people served in community employment, 10 percentage points below the national average, unsurprising given the relative lack of investment. Today, 13 states have passed legislation ending subminimum wage employment. Minnesota is one of 6 states with currently pending legislation to phase out the practice. Bipartisan legislation introduced in Congress would eliminate subminimum wages nationwide. Subminimum wage employment is on its way out. The United States Commission on Civil Rights found that people with intellectual and developmental disabilities earning subminimum wages are not categorically different in their disabilities and levels of support needs from those working in integrated employment. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. The next person is Ms. Hanka. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to testify. For the record, I am Sue Hankner, representing A-Team Minnesota, a state chapter in National A-Team USA. 18 Minnesota is a network of families with a member diagnosed with moderate to profound intellectual or developmental disability. We support increased funding for direct support professionals, ICF homes, and protecting the special minimum wage option. We support efforts to find solutions to reduce or eliminate the collapse of disability services. Our family members who are unable or have limited ability to speak or advocate for themselves rely 24/7 on direct support professionals to just live. We believe no disability service can be safe or effective without a trained and competitively compensated workforce of direct support professionals. We oppose elimination of subminimum wage for these four reasons. First, center-based special minimum wage work is the informed choice of our family members. They want to be with their community and do the work they want at their own pace. Second, our family members and guardians were excluded from representation on the subminimum wage task force. Third, 18 Minnesota met with the task force consultant recommending they visit and examine existing 14C centers using the special minimum wage to gain factual information and to talk with those who chose to work there. That was not done. Number four, there's no economic gain for our family members in paying them a minimum wage. Instead of planning to phase out a chosen work option, we recommend investing in the development of a full array of employment options with built-in infrastructure supports from which all people with disabilities can choose. Finally, we are outraged that an informed choice of our family members might be taken away, with the implication that the families who have lived alongside their family members with a significant intellectual or developmental disability for their entire lives are not trusted to know what their family members want and need. To quote the group of 30 parents I was with last night, it is just wrong. We respectfully implore you to not take this choice away from our family members. Thank you for listening.
Thank you so much. Mr. Brady, followed by Kat.
Yeah.
Welcome to the testify table. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed. It will be followed by Kat and then Father Harry Hattigan. Also, please stay close to the testify table.
Hello, my name is Josh Brady. I am 28 years old and I live in Eden Prairie. I had a hard time finding a job. The day program I go to has a team that goes and cleans places. I was told it was not a good fit because I am blind. I wanted a job that paid me a lot of money. So I went to State Services for the Blind to help me. They believed in me and helped me get a job. I have worked at Pizza Hut for 1 year. I work twice a week to help my coworkers get ready for the busy weekend. I count in bag, bone in, and bone out wings. Get pizza dough. Dough ready and wash dishes. I like working at Pizza Hut. I like being part of their team. I feel good because I get to be out of my house and meet people. I made $11.55 an hour. I like to save the money at Pizza Hut. Pizza Hut to visit my family in Illinois. I like to fly to Illinois by myself. I love working at Pizza Hut. People with disabilities can do a lot. I am blind, but I am a lot of other things. I am smart. I am nice. I am respectful. I am a hard worker. I am able. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Brady. Thank you so much for your
You're testimony welcome.
And sharing with us your story. So we appreciate you coming to the committee today. Kat is next, followed by... Father Hardigan, please come close to the table so we can proceed. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Okay. Hello, Chair and committee members. My name is Kurt Rutson. I'm a disability advocate, and it's nice to see you all today. I'm here to support phasing out some minimum wage for this main reason. Subminimum wage is a way to downgrade the disability community, that person. It's a way of downgrading disabilities, and don't say it's not, because it is. I don't care if it's a disability person or not. And by the way, you guys, we all have disabilities, so get over it. Really quick, get over it. I think, but I'm not sure that we can all agree that people with disabilities, all people do. I'm beginning to wonder about what I sit through down here, my 26th year, I think, down here. And I'm beginning to wonder, but there's always hope, right? If we say yes, they are people, then we need to treat disability people like everyone else in all aspects of life. We can say, oh, we support all our disability people in all other aspects of life. We really do. Oh, man, we really care. We really care. And we will help them out, but in the work aspect setting, we should treat them with the pay that's differently. Is that fair? I mean, life's not fair. I told some people the other day, but I mean, come on, this issue. I want to ask why we treat people differently with the pay. I would love to talk about this with all of you. Let's all go for coffee sometime, and I will buy. Well, maybe. No, just kidding.
We're ready for that coffee.
I was paid this way at one time in my life, way back. And thinking about it, I was sort of ashamed at what I was making for a wage. I felt if I was honest, I was made to feel less than a person. And no one, you guys, should ever feel that way, But they do all the time. Well, maybe I can make a dollar. And they're making 25 an hour. Come on, you guys. Let's just be honest here. I know some of you talk about fairness and all. Let's be fair. And that's good. That's okay. I have heard it all. And I respect that and all. If that is the case, the person isn't in the right job. Let's work together to get them the right job so that they can get paid like everyone else. I thank you so very much for me testifying today, and let's do this. This is way, way overdue. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Rutzen, and thank you so much for your testimony. Father, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you. I am Reverend Harry Hartigan. Thank you for this opportunity to speak with the committee today. I have provided spiritual and moral support to many of the human beings held at MSOP, Moose Lake, and St. Peter. I continue to advocate for these folks. I have been in both MSOP facilities as well as O'Park Heights, Stillwater, and there is no difference how these facilities operate. If it looks like a prison, acts like a prison, it is a prison, not a treatment center. The statistical data provided by DHS regarding Minnesota Sex Offenders Program is shameful and speaks to the lack of oversight by those who should be held accountable for this program. This program was created by the Minnesota legislature, and only the legislature can correct this terrible system which denies individuals their constitutional rights. Institutionalizing human beings who have paid for any wrong they may have done without due process is wrong, wrong, wrong. Fear is not a basis for not doing what is morally right and correct. And correct the wrong done by the legislator when this terrible program was created. Minnesota's sex offenders program is morally wrong and shameful. This program has been reviewed many times, yet corrective action has not been taken. Reports of the legislative auditor of 2011, 2013, the court case, are simply ignored out of fear. 750 human beings are trapped at MSOP with little hope of ever getting out of this shadow prison. More clients have died at Minnesota Sex Offenders Program than have been released. What if this was your child, your partner, your loved one? Is this how you would want them treated? On behalf of all human beings under the control of DHS and the Minnesota Sex Offenders Program, I beg you to do what is morally right and just. I pray that you will do what is right on behalf of the state of Minnesota. I thank you for your time and hold you and yours in prayer.
Thank you so much, Reverend, for your testimony. The next person on the list is Leo Finney, followed by former Representative Sandell. Good afternoon, and welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. The men at the Minnesota Sexual Offender Program, MSOP, wish for me today to talk to you people about the place where they live and the need for your help. All have made many efforts to communicate to the governor, the legislature, the administration of these needs. All of their efforts in this regard are met by silence from the power structure. I want to comment from research that I have access to, which has studied the MSOP program intently. Okay, this is where these men live. January 24th, 2012, comment. MSOP is masquerading as a treatment center. Offenders there who pose little threat to society are almost certainly caught in the MSOP net. The mess goes back to the mid-1990s. August 23rd, 2014, commentary. Critics of the Minnesota Sex Offender Program point to its dumping of people who have completed their prison sentences into so-called treatment centers. Many of these men pose no serious threat, and they get at the so-called treatment center no effective treatment. It took court-appointed experts 2 months, approximately, to find people buried alive in MSOP, people who have no earthly business there and should be released or transferred to another program. The program offers nothing but prison-like incarceration and no serious path towards success in treatment or release. Governor Mark Dayton previously notified his Department of Human Services, DHS, which controls MSOP, that he likes to program just fine the way it is.
If you could wrap up your testimony.
Excuse me?
If you can wrap up your testimony, please. With many other folks who wanted to testify today.
If I can wrap it up?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let me do that.
We'll have another time for you to testify, and also because you requested to come back next week too.
Okay.
While you're finalizing, Representative Sandell, former Representative Sandell, please come to the testify table. And then followed by Erin Hubert. And then we'll have Kathy Taylor next after that.
Okay. Step down now? Oh, I thought I had one more comment. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony.
Sorry I went over.
You can always send your written testimony to the committee, and we'll make sure that everyone receives it.
Okay.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Noor, Lead New Brindley, members, Mr. Herring and staff, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Steve Sandell, a constituent in District 47B, much of Woodbury, and formerly a member of this committee. I'm here on behalf of the men and women incarcerated in the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. Otherwise, I'm speaking for myself. I learned about MSOP in 2020 when I received a letter from a resident at the Moose Lake facility. Since then, I've spoken with Commissioner Harpstead, members of her staff, and residents. Many of individuals correspond with me weekly. I visited facilities at Moose Lake and St. Peter, and I participate in the Resident Family Council and Advisory Board. MSOP is one of only 20 similar programs in the nation. It is the largest and most expensive. The average length of stay is the longest in the nation. 750 individuals, some of whom are in their 80s, some of whom have been there for 30 years, are currently confined. All of them have served their court-imposed prison sentence. The commitment is indeterminate. Their civil rights suspended. In the last 30 years, only 17 individuals have been released. 90 have died there. The program has no statistical impact on the rate of sexual aggression and assault. MSOP is a $250 million budget item. You should understand that there is no statutory or implied limit to the Minnesota Sex Offender Program budget, no limit to the number of individuals who can be assigned for commitment. Critical reports have appeared in numerous local, national, and professional publications. The legislative auditor and a court-appointed task force both published two critical reviews of the program. A lawsuit challenging its constitutionality remains unresolved. A year ago, a legislative hearing was held. Two speakers made presentations. No question or discussion was allowed. An article in yesterday's Star Tribune by reporter Chris Sears indicated the continuing problematic nature of this program. Yet there is no independent oversight of its policies and practices, no consistent standard to be met, no published peer evaluation. I drafted a bill in the last legislative session emphasizing prevention, support for all affected by irresponsible and dangerous sexual behavior, establishing an oversight committee, and providing money for research leading to more effective treatment and healing. Our caucus leadership asked me to withhold the bill, concerned that it would cause political repercussion. I regret that I did. I've contacted each of you, encouraging your attention to this program and offering language for a bill that would modestly move toward reform. All of us told our constituents when we campaigned that we would responsibly face difficult issues, promised honest and respectful conversation on even uncomfortable topics. I know that sexual aggression and assault are heinous crimes and can leave a history of trauma and pain, and that some of the individuals currently confined should continue residential therapy and treatment. But I also know that our society believes in repentance, reform, civil rights, rehabilitation, and healing. The legislature created MSOP and is responsible to its constituents and taxpayers for its operations until, including the very substantial expense, $300,000 a day.
Business Center, I think the time...
I'm not... let me finish. I'm okay. Talking about a $250,000. I'm only asking for 180 seconds. I'm here asking for no more money. I am asking that this committee take a close look at the budget item and decide if you want to continue to invest in a punitive, deeply flawed, and ineffective program or find a better path that would invest in human capital, aggressively strengthen education and prevention, support victims and their families, and seek the most effective therapy and treatment, and in the end, prove a benefit to public safety and public health. Ladies and gentlemen, Trends, and Chairman New, thank you very much for your indulgence.
Thank you. Aaron, Aaron was followed by Kathy. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Erin Hubert with the Long-Term Care Imperative, and I have been reflecting a great deal on what to say today, how to accurately convey on behalf of seniors and their caregivers the level of disappointment and despair that they have with respect to the governor's proposed budget. Many of them were here a week ago. Dozens met with you and your colleagues. They left nearly 1,000 letters with the governor seeking his help. Since 2020, 2,597 nursing home beds have been taken out of service statewide. That is the equivalent of 52 50-bed nursing homes. 1 week ago, a nursing home outside of Crookston announced that it will be closing its doors. And I know that Representative Keel can't be with us today, but we spoke at some length about what this means for her community. The average starting wage in a nursing home is about $17 an hour. And it is no wonder that we have a workforce shortage, because that is not enough to support raising a family. Despite this, there is nothing in either the budget or the supplemental budget to propose increasing wages for our nursing home frontline workers. Some keep implying that the forecast is a guarantee of funding. Let's be clear, the forecast is a really important tool for the purpose of governing. It is not money in the door for nursing homes. It's not something they can use to extend a loan or pay their bills or deposit at a bank to pay wages. We are just coming out of a pandemic that has decimated our workforce, our reserves, and the spirit of many of our caregivers that at some point was so bad the governor had to call out the National Guard for help. Last month, there was an 84-year-old woman named Mary Eileen who testified before this very committee. And the last thing I want to say is to remind you of what she said. Quote, "I know there are many deserving of consideration in your budget this year. I would just like to remind you, because we do feel forgotten at times. We are your elders. We hold the stories, memories, and life of our communities. We are the bearers of light of wisdom. We need nourishment, attention, and caring. So we deeply ask that the members of this committee show leadership in making sure that seniors and their caregivers are part of One Minnesota." Thank you.
Thank you so much. Kathy Taylor, followed by Jerry. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Knorr and members of the committee. My name is Kathy Tyler, and I live in Eden Prairie. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on behalf of my very special disabled sister, Debbie, who lives in Bloomington. Debbie has experienced firsthand the effects of losing a special minimum wage job in an attempt to find work in the regular job market. Debbie was with LifeWorks at the time they dropped their 14C certificate in 2017. Instead of working in a supervised environment that she loved, she was taken on interview after interview in an attempt to find minimum wage work. She was rejected and embarrassed again and again. Debbie didn't even want the job she was applying for, as she is unable to stand for long periods of time or work an eight-hour shift. She wanted to keep the work she had. LifeWorks never did find Debbie a minimum wage job, and after endless interviews, told us there was nothing more they could do. They recommended that we look for another program. We happily took Debbie out of LifeWorks and enrolled her in Opportunity Partners, which provided special minimum wage work, a reason to leave her apartment every day, and interaction with the staff and coworkers around her. It is a perfect fit. Debbie has a strong work ethic. She has no interest in going to a day program to do puzzles and watch movies. She wants to work for pay and every day tells us about the work she has accomplished. She is on Social Security, which pays for her living expenses, and the money she earns at Opportunity is used for extras. I believe the purpose of this bill is to help the disabled by mandating employers to pay them minimum wage. But if in actuality it causes a devastating loss of employment for those least able to secure jobs, is that helping? If this bill passes, the damage to the disabled will be vast. It is a certainty that Debbie's job and thousands of others will go away. What a nightmare. 14C jobs are an answer to prayer. Please vote no to keep them. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chairman Knorr and committee members. I am Jerry Menke. I'm the father to my son, Stephen, and an advocate for many others, individuals with disabilities. Stephen was at a program that decided not to renew their 14C and was transferred to a life enrichment program. This was not a preferred option for him, so we helped him find a program that offered a special wage option. He now is part of a crew in a private sector warehouse assembling insulated boxes for medications to be mailed home. And he is paid a special minimum wage. He takes great pride, and I quote, "I'm helping people who need medicine." He enjoys the camaraderie of his fellow workers. He has limited vision and lacks fine motor skills. He is able to work because of day program staff. They get him to and from the work he loves. They monitor his seizure medicines, and they work with him to improve his productivity and wage. DHS is always promoting person-centered planning. If the person and his guardians agree that the pay in question is fair, who is it to say that they cannot have the right, and I quote from the Constitution, the right to pursuing their own happiness? Work is its own reward. Steve would almost work for free. He's so. Ask why the wording was put in place to begin with. It was done, I thought, to help your constituents have the ability to be part of the community and contribute as much as they could, despite their disability. As a previous business owner that outsourced work to day programs, I can assure you there were no middlemen or brokers that approached me in all my years of business. What the monies I paid to these programs went to the individuals. The ARC of Minnesota states on their website, current jobs in the day program can continue. We just want the day programs to pay the minimum wage. Well, you just don't pull it out of thin air if you're a businessman. I would pay to the program individuals what I would pay my own employees to do the particular job. I couldn't pay more or I would have lost the business and in the end lost my customer. With many different levels of disabilities, some make the minimum wage, others not, but they all enjoy being part of the team and getting a paycheck. If this goes forward, most will not be working at all. Do not eliminate the special wage for, program. Any questions?
Thank you so much. We'll
thank you.
Kathy Kabokovich, welcome to the committee, and then followed by John Barker, and then Professor Rangi. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you. My name is Katie Kavakovich. I'm a resident of St. Paul, a licensed social worker, and I'm testifying.
Someone will take up that.
Okay. Please. Okay. Thank you. I'm testifying on behalf of my mother, Dawn, and older sister, Laura. Laura is on the severe end of the autism spectrum, has scattered skills and capabilities, unpredictable and sometimes violent behavior, and low emotional regulation abilities. Laura is unable to testify in person regarding our position on this bill, which threatens to eliminate her right to work at her own pace and ability. The impacts of this bill could potentially devastate the quality of life for my sister and over 5,000 people who have disabilities that limit their capability to work at a competitive level. The proposed amendment to Section 1, Subdivision 6, specifically outlines prohibition of special certificates, 14C, for what is often referred to as subminimum wages. Contrary to negative publicity, the certificates are a special needs accommodation based on individual productivity, commensurate with prevailing minimum wage. These wages are not subminimum to the output that these employees are able to produce. It is a provision that allows people who are typically unemployable or in the current labor market to have the choice to work at their own pace and ability. Without this provision, most of these people will no longer be able to work at all. Additionally, the people who utilize this program typically qualify for other government programs to support their living expenses and do not depend on this income to live. It is to be clearly understood that employment under a 14C special wage certificate is a choice, as is employment in a specialized disability center program with trained supervisory staff. Prohibition of this choice is extremely discriminatory to people like my sister, who will never be able to work successfully outside of this model due to the nature and severity of her disability. The option to work in a competitive setting for competitive wages has never been compromised or limited by allowing these individuals the right to choose what works for them. There is no data that shows any economic or social benefit to the elimination of this program. Forcing employers to pay minimum wage or higher to individuals who are not able to meet baseline expectations for job performance, while at the same time often needing extensive supervision and other accommodation, has already rendered serious consequences. Rather than increasing the rate of employment for people with disabilities, it has led to closures of already underfunded programs and will continue to do so. It is neither feasible nor realistic to expect one-to-one long-term job coaching in a competitive work environment to be successful for this subset of the population. This bill automatically relegates them to adult daycare, which is highly discriminatory to those who would prefer to work. The provisions for direct service professionals cannot be filled, and our indications that ending 14C would be a tragic mistake. The burden is then transferred to families who need to drop out of the workforce to care for their family member. My sister has blossomed in her specialized work center, loves her job, supervisors, and coworkers, and this environment provides the critical predictability, adapted schedule, and developmentally appropriate activity choices and socialization that she craves. The competitive labor market is overwhelming and unpredictable to her, setting off extreme tantrums and violent outbursts. She does not gain a sense of belonging or of a peer group when she is a minority among the non-disabled. She believes she should have the right to choose what works best for her, just like everyone else. Please do everything you can to prevent the elimination of commensurate wages and specialized work centers for people like my sister by protecting 14C. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Chair Norr and committee members, my name is John Wayne Barker, and I'm the executive director of Mary Kink, a day program that offers a full array of service options to meet the informed choice of 400 adults with disabilities. Having managed special wage operations for 25 years, I'm uniquely qualified to correctly explain how it works. Our special minimum wage is based on a prevailing wage, which in 2023 is $15 an hour. If non-disabled workers can assemble 15 widgets an hour, then each widget's worth a dollar. Clients in our program making 15 widgets make $15 an hour. Those making 10 are paid 10, and so on. The rest of my testimony, I'm going to go off script because we had a perfect example this afternoon of a special minimum wage. I've noted that everybody's been held to the two-minute limit except Josh and Kurt, because Josh and Kurt have special circumstances that require special accommodations for them to testify, and they were given a longer period of time. That's exactly what the special minimum wage does. It provides people in special circumstances an opportunity to work and make a meaningful wage based on their productivity to a non-disabled standard. You've been told this is a civil rights issue, and if that were true, you can bet the Disability Law Center would have filed a lawsuit. What is a civil rights issue is taking a legal choice away from a protected class. You've also been told that the federal government will soon be eliminating the 14C provision, and that is also untrue. It is likely that some of you have a family member with a disability or know someone personally with a disability, and certainly all of you have constituents earning a special minimum wage. And I have three rhetorical questions for you. In what world does it make sense to pay two workers the same wage when one is only making seven widgets? In what world does it make sense to listen to a few proponents of eliminating 14C in this room and not the thousands of people with disabilities most impacted that cannot be here to advocate for themselves? In what world do Minnesota representatives take a choice away from vulnerable adults? Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony, Professor Wernsch, followed by Danny Eckert. Welcome to the committee. Please come to the testify table so we can... Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chairman Noor, members of the committee. My name is Carlisle Ford Runge. I appear on behalf of my daughter, Elizabeth Runge, and as a member of the economics faculty at the University of Minnesota. While appeal on behalf of disabled workers is emotionally affecting. Analysis and evidence suggests that eliminating 14C wages will hurt, not help, disabled workers at disability employment centers. I'd like to make 3 points. First, suppose that an employer at a supermarket faces the choice of hiring someone to stock shelves. One applicant can stock them at twice the rate of another applicant who has cerebral palsy. Both are required to be paid the same minimum wage. Who will get the job? Probably not the disabled worker. Without the sub-minimum wage allowance, even employers who want to hire the disabled will have a disincentive to do so, and many more workers will find that they never get jobs at all. If the adjusted wage is eliminated, it is the most disabled wage earners who will be most at risk. Their welfare will be sacrificed cruelly by forcing wages into an untenable bracket while they are sent to their group homes to sit unemployed and alone. Second, this bill has been supported in the name of freedom of choice. You have in your documents a letter from 2 U.S. Civil Rights Commissioners written 2 days ago condemning this legislation and noting that 98% of comments oppose it nationally. Finally, evidence from 3 other states that have eliminated below minimum wages is deeply disturbing. In Maine, 2/3 of the disabled former workshop employees are now unemployed. In Washington State, 80%. In Vermont, there are now fewer developmentally disabled adults in supported employment than in 2002. In sum, this bill will raise unemployment among disabled workers, is inequitable in failing to acknowledge disability as differentiating some people from others, and runs directly in the face of evidence from other states. I urge you to not approve the proposed changes to Section 14C. Thank you.
Thank you. Please welcome to the committee and introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Danny Acker, and I serve as the Director of State Government Relations for the Minnesota Hospital Association. MHA supports Hospital 2847, Article 2, Section 69, which directs the Commissioner of Human Services to conduct a study on options to expand access to services for people with co-occurring behavioral health conditions and disabilities. The study directs the Commissioner to evaluate strategies to decrease the number of people who remain in hospitals, jails, and other acute or crisis settings when they no longer need or meet medical or other necessary criteria. Unnecessary discharge delays and hospital boarding is a consistent and growing issue across Minnesota's hospitals and health systems. Our members continually express grave concern for the steady increase in the number of patients with co-occurring conditions that do not meet inpatient standards of care but have little to no other care options other than the emergency room. We strongly support this study, encourage this committee and the legislature to consider similar ongoing efforts and action on this. Subsequently, MHA also supports the new acute care transition provisions added in the amendment, specifically the acute care transitions temporary payment program. This program is aimed at addressing barriers to people with complex high acuity needs transitioning from acute care settings to community and residential services. We view this temporary program as an important starting point, an investment that will help patients get to the right care setting at the right time. I want to thank Commissioner Harpstead, the governor's office, and other key stakeholders that participated in developing this. It's a good starting point, and we encourage your consideration and support on that. In closing, I cannot stress enough how dire the healthcare workforce crisis is right now across all care settings and all care providers. I implore this committee and the legislature to support the 2 provisions that I spoke to, other workforce provisions in this bill, and I strongly support any efforts to develop, recruit, and retain our healthcare workforce. Thank you.
Thank you so much for the testimony. Ms. Flynn, welcome to the committee. Please introduce
yourself. Good afternoon, Chair Norr and members of the committee. My name is Dolores Flynn, and I live in Roseville. I'm here on behalf of my union, SEIU Healthcare of Minnesota and Iowa. We support House File 2847, the Governor's Human Service Budget Bill. To start, I want to highlight the $84.7 million investment to address Minnesota's long-term care workforce shortage, especially the grants to support new Americans. We also endorse a proposal to phase out the use of sub-minimum wages. We want to thank Governor Walz for being our champion. This bill will ratify and fund our most recent home care contract and related MOUs. The bill invests $298 million this biennium and $478 million in the next biennium for a contract that will address this workforce crisis. I am 78 years old and a full-time caregiver for my 52-year-old son due to this crisis. There are over 10,000 unfilled PCA jobs across the state. Our contract agreement includes a minimum wage increase from $15.25 an hour to $20 an hour over 2 years, a $1,000 retention bonus for those who have worked at least 6 months, a wage scale for experienced workers. Caregivers who invest in this work will finally see a step increase up to $22.50 per hour. We also won the ability to shape an orientation program with DHS. This is an opportunity to give the caregivers the support and information they need. 22 years ago, my son had a massive brain hemorrhage that left him a total care patient. When COVID hit, I had to become his paid caregiver. We couldn't find workers. My husband and I are both 78. There are many other elderly parents taking care of their children. This bill will invest in the workforce we need and let caregivers know that there will be someone to care for our disabled children in the future. We are all just a heartbeat away from requiring these cares. It happens in just seconds. Maybe that is why our contracts have always had strong bipartisan support. And I hope we earn your support this year. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. The last but not the least is Mr. Magnuson. Welcome to the committee, John, and proceed with your testimony.
Well, thank you, Chairman Noor and members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Mac.
Everything is okay. Please proceed.
All right. I hope we'll start the clock over. Thank you. My name is John Magnuson, a non-operator board member of MASH, the Minnesota Association of Sober Homes. MASH's primary mission is to promote the establishment, successful management, and growth of high-quality community-based sober living residences. I'm grateful for my 3 decades of lived experience working with patients, providers, and policymakers. Most recently, I had a 5-year stint leading MARCH, the Association of Treatment Providers in the state. And recently, after my daughter attempted suicide, I resigned and committed myself to being a life recovery coach to help families and individuals that are dealing with substance use and mental health issues. As I do that work, I've learned firsthand just how important these sober homes are. While Section 24 of HF 2847 has the idea of increasing access to sober housing and providing consumer protections, it could actually have the opposite effect, creating instead a sober housing crisis at a time of opioid epidemic and other devastating effects in our society. Already, we've heard from numerous members that the staffing and medication handling requirements of this bill are enacted would cost the compliance would cost them. Let me illustrate. Many sober homes operate at a $550 per person per month rate for 10 people. Hiring credentialing staff members at a cost of $40,000 annually increases the cost of sober living to $883. I'm not certain how that would expand the opportunity for people. In addition, last session, the legislature commissioned a DHS sober housing report. We still haven't seen that, and it's 6 months overdue. What's the rush in moving forward when we don't have the facts? In addition, we're asking for DHS is asking for $1 million to create a certification process. Yet MASH already does that. I could go on and on. We've put in a list for the record of the many additional things that really bring us to the conclusion that this bill is not yet ready for prime time, or this section of the bill, And so we simply request a pause and a removal of Section 24 from HF 2847 or any other reforms to the sober housing this session. There's no good reason to threaten the existing sober housing marketplace for political or perceived urgency. Let's do the right thing the first time. Our families who I work with, who live in your communities, deserve no less. So thank you, Chair.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Members, we are now in the discussion period. So Representative Huang.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with the changes in this bill, I want some, I guess, clarification. Over the years, I've known a lot of people that work at home, a lot of times because they have young children, but they get commission on what they produce, and oftentimes it's craft things. So if it's crocheting, knitting, or woodworking, they make them and they get paid per item from some entity. And that commission or per piece pay, would that be outlawed by this? Because based, I'm trying to see, it sounds like some of the activity is by you build something or you do a specific function and you get paid for that function. And I know that in the non outside of the handicap and disabled community, there are people that are being paid in this fashion, and it's been going on for years. And I thought it was legal. So that's what I'm trying to determine, if this would get rid of all, or there would still be some situations where a commission or pay per piece would be allowed.
I can see Mr. Nelson wanted to speak on that. She was part of the task force. Please make it brief and introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Noor. I am the co-chair of the Task Force on Eliminating Subminimum Wage. The provisions in the governor's bill came directly from the work that we did as a task force. What you're speaking to is more of a consignment style work. The only time, and consignment style work is essentially a business model that individuals can enter and buy their choice. It's based on how you choose to price your products and how those products are sold. The only place that this would eliminate paying subminimum wage is in business that hold a Section 14C license. Being able to sell your product for a wage that equals out to less than minimum wage, that is simply a business choice that business makers make. This is just asking that we no longer allow that to be a trackable wage for an hourly work. I would also like to comment that Mr. Barker referenced Josh and Kurt as having an accommodation to be able to perform their testimony here. Accommodations are protected in all employment settings under the Americans with Disabilities Act. I, as an autistic lobbyist, have several accommodations through my employer, and we do not require subminimum wage to accommodate people with disabilities in the workplace. That is a right protected to us by the federal government.
Mr. Chair, can I get a testifier that will answer my question?
I think she's...
No, she didn't. My question specifically, would this get rid of that type?
No, it would not.
It would not, which means that they could still, they just would not be underneath this special because it's an allowed form of employment in the state of Minnesota for any person. So we would be treating everyone the same by allowing this to happen, so that the different sides on this argument, the one side, you would still be able to do a commission or per piece price activity. And I just wanted confirmation that that activity could still go on. And I didn't really hear a yes or no. So if there's someone that could actually answer the question
I think I can provide
concisely.
This is about the employment versus someone who's doing more of a hands-on, self-employed, trying to earn extra income or other things that they need to do. That's a separate component than what we're discussing here today.
Well, Mr. Chair, if some group had a day facility so that people wishing to do commission type work could get together there and do it, and in the facility they had additional support for personnel that and people that needed it, because there are locations where people doing craft and this type of work can come together and do it because they've got maybe some special equipment that they use in a certain part of it. So you were saying no, but I'm trying to get clarification that there is a way that this could be done, that if this law goes through.
It doesn't address that. So we'll get you back.
Okay, then you give me the data.
We'll give you the information about it. Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair. So I'm just curious. So when the task force was created, it was in 2020 or 2021? Is that, and how many people were on the task force? I'm just, because I'm new here, I want to just understand that.
Mr. Nelson is here, and I think there's a whole booklet. I wish it was part of the package, but if anybody needs the booklets, are right there.
Representative North, thank you. The task force consisted of 16 people. It was leaders appointed by a number of different organizations, people with disabilities. We did have parents of people with disabilities present. We had members from DEED. We had members from the State Rehabilitation Council. We had members from organizations that hold subminimum wage certificates and members that did not hold subminimum wage certificates. We also spoke with over 454 Minnesotans to get input on this plan, including the A-team. They had their private listening session with our consulting group, and we heard over and over from families that a lot of the information that we were able to offer about options and benefits, that alleviated their concerns.
So as of hearing testimony today and just understanding the process, I don't know if the task force was charged with, you know, like the responsibility of calculating like the short and long-term effects of on the workforce. Having a family member who has cerebral palsy, and knowing that my cousin for almost 15 years has worked for a local place that, and he's a greeter, and he's impacted so many, but if he's not, he's qualified for 14C. And if this is taken away, he will not be that bright face that everybody gets to see. And when we talk about equity, inclusion, we talk about opportunities and how to take the stigma away. If people that are qualifying, the thousands of people, not only in the state of Minnesota, but nationally, hearing the national report that 98% of people that are involved are commenting saying, we need this for our loved ones, we need this opportunity so they can have jobs. I want my children to be around people that are of all walks of life. And it would be heartbreaking to take this away and have them go back into a day program when life is more robust when we find our purpose, when we do things that we love. I would just beg this committee to pause this. This is a lot of information. It's overwhelming to me emotionally to think that my cousin, he's given 15 years of his life to greeting people at Walmart and has just blessed our community. Literally, he would not be able to be there. And so I sometimes get a little frustrated because I feel there's a little bit of a smugness and I don't understand it. When people that are on this task force of 16 people, and we've just talked about making a task force of 28 to hit all areas and walks of life, why would we not expand it to make more opportunity to really get the data and understand the long-term cost that's going to come back to the taxpayers and the quality of life for people? So that's all I got.
Briefly, Ms. Nelson.
I empathize with you, Representative Gelman. I have family members with significant disabilities, and to be completely honest, my employment journey hasn't always been what you see in front of you now. This bill is set up to protect those people. There is nothing here that says that your nephew cannot continue to be a greeter and continue to work in that program. This bill offers extensive support to providers, including providers like Merrick, to allow them to restructure and keep their doors open. The supported day programs and the supported employment does not need to end. What needs to end is the violation of human rights and treating people with disabilities as less than. I am not paid less than minimum wage, but this impacts my worth as a human being. Just like Kurt said, and I want to point out that we saw, I'll finish up one last comment.
Other member questions, so I'll go to.
Can I just wrap it up with one thing? We heard from 100% of parents that they don't want this. We heard from 100% of people with disabilities they do.
I think your time is up on that, so I'll go to Lead New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if Ms. Bailey would stand for a couple of questions, I do have a couple of questions. Thank you, Ms. Bailey. I'm looking through the slide deck on slide 12. It's the new acute care transitions, and the Hospital Association testified to this. Certainly, I think it is a good use of those temporary funds, right? We've got a major, as it's termed in here, compression problem, right? We've got folks who are staying in hospitals longer than they should, and hospitals are not being reimbursed for that. My concern is, and my question to you, and I'm sorry that you get to answer on behalf of all of DHS, but my question is, does DHS believe that hospitals can really decompress? I understand that this will help hospitals continue to stay afloat when they're holding people and not getting other reimbursements, but are they really going to be able to decompress if staffing and funding at our nursing homes is not increased?
Director, if I can introduce yourself again and then proceed.
Thank you, Chair Noor and Representative New Brindley. For the record, Elise Bailey, Budget Director for the Department. I think that's a really great question. You know, this is a really challenging problem that the state has had for a very long time. And so what we're trying to do with this proposal is to have multiple strategies to try to grapple with the problem and measure their effectiveness. I would also say in our budget, we also have a lot of resources for community providers, such as group homes and in-home providers, to get rate increases to attract the staff. So I think the vision of the proposal is to utilize one-time money to see if if hospitals and community-based providers are able to shift people out of nursing homes in a quicker fashion, and to also sustain that in the community, so sustain the services for the individual person in the community. It isn't clear whether it's a failure of not having nursing beds, but rather these folks will likely need to be served by providers of group homes, mental health facilities, those kinds of settings. So it will be yet to be seen, though. As I said, you know, it's a problem that we're grappling with. We don't think that we have a silver bullet. We don't think there is one, but that we want to measure the effectiveness of this and maybe come back in 2 years and say, you know, this did make a real impact.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Director Bailey, for that. And I do appreciate that it is complicated, and we do need to have multiple areas or avenues to attack the problem. One problem I'm having, and I have the full change document, and I'm really trying to get my arms around how much money is actually in this budget for our nursing homes. You know, I mean, I understand that we have money for different pots. I'm trying to get my arms around how much money we have in this budget for our nursing homes. Do you know that number?
Director Bailey.
Chair Noor, Representative New Brindley, we have one proposal in the budget on critical access nursing homes. I believe it's 1.9 in the first biennium and 2 million in the second. We also have a technical proposal around rebasing the rates according to some technical changes the federal government made. But beyond that, the governor and lieutenant governor really had a vision about what is the landscape of the direct care workforce, and how do people get paid? How much do they get paid? And what is in the current forecast? And sometimes, you know, you have to make decisions based on that. And the median wage for instance, nursing assistants is $19.80, and the median wage in the elderly waiver program, for instance, for day services was around $13. And so that's the lens that we used and the governor used to put together this budget on how do we really make sure that people with disabilities and older adults have access to care that they need. And it was a holistic look at the whole landscape. We also looked at how have rates gone up over time. And VBR, since the implementation of it, has gone up 83% compared to the average rate at that point in time. And so that's the vision. It's not that the governor and lieutenant governor doesn't think that nursing homes shouldn't get a rate increase. It's just there's limited resources, and we had to look at what the whole landscape was and ensure that the people at the end of the day that want services and are looking for services, that they can access them whatever setting that they're in.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this will be my last comment. That is alarming to me. We just heard testimony that a nursing home is closing right now. Right now. I heard Critical Access is getting $4 million over the biennium, and then I was told that we have limited resources. We literally have more resources right now than we have ever had in the history of our state. If we don't have the resources right now to take care of our seniors and our disability community, we'll never have money. I cannot tell you how alarming and disheartening it is for me to hear that our governor and lieutenant governor do not think that at a time of an almost $18 billion budget surplus, we don't have money for our senior citizens and our disability community. This is shocking to me. And I get it, it's not all ongoing money, but there's over $5 billion of ongoing money. This is not about limited resources, this is about choices. And the choices we should make in these rooms and in that capital are to take care of our most vulnerable citizens. I am frankly disgusted by the lack of care for our seniors and our disabled brothers and sisters in this state. I'm embarrassed.
Representative Beck, and then we'll go back to Director.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Again, I just want to make a comment more to the members here at the table. Regarding the ORAC conversation, most of you know through my personal involvement in that, I'm the chair of it right now. We have had a lot of discussions about changing our makeup of the council. We've had discussions, should we expand it? Where should we expand it? The governor has tried for a number of years to try to put a member on every on the council from every Native American community. We understand the need. The council actually talked about that a lot about 2 years ago and decided not to. Because it tips the whole balance of what the whole council is working towards. This truly bipartisan act that happened in 2019 was really well thought through. 19 members, two seats currently held by the Native American communities. They currently get a flat $3 million, I think, and maybe some change off the licensing fees. We are doing so much for our Native American communities, but I think it's just, I think what bothers me most to hear again is just the arrogance and the need to just rewrite legislation that was really painfully gone through in a way that should be something that we stand up for. If the governor and his folks want to come to us and suggest what you'd like to do, I would suggest talking to the chair, talking to the council about this. We are changing our scoring system so that more of our dollars do go to communities of color. Right now, without any mandates, because he wants a 50% mandate, it goes to certain communities. We're already doing 40%, 42% actually, because a year ago he wanted 40%. I'm just, the more mandates, the more rules, the more things you put us in, it doesn't make our job easier, it makes it harder. And we are changing the scoring system, folks. At last Friday's meeting, it's changing. The governor's office ought to pay attention to what we are doing before he makes a bunch of changes to this that does not help our ORAC mission. I'm sure we'll talk about this more, Mr. Chair. This is frustrating when we're not getting this communication. So thank you for the time.
Thank you, Director Bailey, for the closing. And then for 30 seconds, we have got another bill. Representative Edelson, please come to the testify table so we can also finish that bill.
Well, thank you, Chair and representatives, for hearing our bill and for all the questions and for the public for coming to testify about your opinions. I would say on the opioid epidemic, to speak to you, Representative Baker, we appreciate working with you, but we are alarmed at the number of deaths and specifically the number of deaths in the American Indian community. And so we feel like we put together a package that is really targeted and that tries to really, really, really move the needle. And I know you're passionate about that as well, so happy to work with you on that. For the larger package, thanks again for the bill, and happy to answer any questions later.
Thank you. With that, I renew my motion that House File 2847 to be laid over. The bill is laid over. We'll have more conversation, members. So we're moving to the next bill. Representative Edelson, welcome to the committee. I will move House File 1434 to be laid over for possible inclusion. Please proceed with your testimony. We'll be more quick on this one. We've got a few minutes to go through.
I'll be very quick, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to note, I think it's really important that we acknowledge that this room right here is not really necessarily ADA compliant. Not your fault, but it is, given the conversation today, I just want to make note of that.
We're getting a new building, so yeah. Make sure that we get it.
Okay. House File 1434 deals with TEFRA fees. So TEFRA fees are tax equity and fiscal responsibility. It was a fee that was established in 1988 in recognition of the desired community to do essentially a supplemental program. We heard this in policy, and with this, Mr. Chair, I don't know how much you want me to go into the bill. What this does is essentially eliminate the fees, and I'll just leave it at that to my testifier.
Your testimony, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you so much, Chair Noor and committee members. My name is Maren Christensen-Hofer, and I'm the parent of a child with a disability, a former subscriber to the TEFRA system, and I also serve a nonprofit organization called the Multicultural Autism Action Network. And I'm here today to ask for your support for House File 1434 regarding the parental fees. And just to make it clear what this is, the TEFRA and home and community-based services offer a pathway for families who don't meet the income requirements for medical assistance, a way for families to access those programs. And some of you heard from families in the policy committee when we talked about the hardships that families face when they're forced to pay these fees. In our own family, our TEFRA fee was higher than our mortgage every month. We heard from two-income families where one parent was forced to leave the workforce because of the effect that the two-income household had on their parental fees. We heard from families who declined promotions, who declined inheritances, who took out second mortgages. I know of one family that even declared bankruptcy as a result of their TEFRA fees. We know of families whose wages are garnished because of the incredibly high TEFRA fees that can range from a couple hundred to even a couple $1,000s per month. Some families are under the misconception that TEFRA is a program that only affects the wealthy or the rich, but I would invite all of you to take a look at the parental fee calculator that's on DHS's website to calculate what those fees would be for your own family. And just as an example, for a single parent with a family with an income of about $80,000 with two children, they would pay a parental fee of about $400 a month, and that is in addition to their private insurance fees. So they can be very steep and very difficult to pay for many families. But despite this, many families are willing to make this huge financial sacrifice and pay these fees because there's so many things that our private insurance simply does not cover, things like therapies and early intervention and consumables and durable medical equipment that are absolutely essential to safe, independent life at home for our kids.
We know that these things are really a requirement for any family with a child with a disability, but yet there are some families that go without because the parental fees are so high. And just to give you an example of that, you know, some families go without early intervention services that can be life-changing for those families and really impact the trajectory of that child over their lifetime. As Representative Edelson mentioned, you know, these fees began at a time when the state saw imposing parental fees on people with disabilities and their families as a way to balance the state's budget woes. And I think that was a mistake when it was done, and we're certainly in a very good position to solve that problem now. We have an opportunity to make a change in policy that would have an immediate and dramatic impact on the quality of life for children with disabilities and their families. So that's what we're asking you to do today. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Member discussion? Seeing Representative Hicks.
I'll be super quick. I don't know if Elise is still here, but just out of curiosity, what is the return on investment for the department? Like, how much do they collect versus what they spend on FTEs and tracking people down? And no.
That's a loaded question, so she's coming down. Director Bailey, welcome back again. Please, I don't know if you had the question.
I did hear the question. Thank you, Chair Representative Hicks. We can get that information. Oh, do you have it? Okay. We will get that information.
Appreciate that.
Thanks.
With your final closing statement.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate you getting this bill in. It's an important one. I just want to note that the TEFRA is based on your income. When you look at say supplemental insurance for, say, seniors, or if you have a disability, you do not have to pay a fee. Medicare supplemental insurance is just one cost. So, I mean, this really does end up being incredibly burdensome for families. We should do something on this year, and I thank you for consideration.
With that, I renew my motion, House File 1434, to be laid over so the bill is laid over. No further agenda items. We are now adjourned.